right, welcome back. In this next module, we're going to focus on the web space specifically, and we'll look at ASP.NET. We're going to look at the core ASP.NET and some of the core feature changes with the framework, with web forms. We're going to take a look at ASP.NET MVC and a couple of the new features there, and also at dynamic data. We're also going to talk briefly about the Ajax story, which got interesting about a week or so ago. Things changed a little bit, so we'll talk a little bit about what happened there. So one of the things that a lot of companies are really thinking about now and focused on, with search being this huge thing, right? Today, when you want to go find something on the web, you go to your favorite search engine, right? Whatever that might be. Type in what you're looking for, and you hope that it shows up on that first page, right? And those search engines are working around the clock, working really hard to, those folks are trying to make sure that that's what happens. As a consumer, that's what you think about. As a site owner, right, what you're probably thinking about is, how do I make sure that when people go into their favorite search engine and search, they find me, right? Hopefully when they're looking for something you have to offer, and not, you don't always want to show up on the first page for sure. So how do you do that, right? And so people have been focused on, how do we optimize our websites for the search engines that are out there crawling them? And a number of different things have come up. It turns out that search engines prefer or use certain information more than others. So things like the URL. Right? If your URL actually contains the information that somebody's searching for, then your chances of getting higher up in the search rankings are better. They look at keywords, right, and the metadata, the things that are in your pages. And so as you start thinking about building your sites and optimizing for that, there's a couple of key things that have been added to the framework to make it easier for you to do that. One is that metadata and keyword information that goes into the page is now programmatically accessible. So within your code, you can go in and set those things. You don't have to put them in statically in the ASPX. You can do that behind the scenes, which for a dynamic site makes a huge difference. You may have the same ASPX page, but it's very dynamic and serving up details on a number of different things. You want to be able to change those keywords in that metadata so that they match what people are viewing and what people then ultimately search for. The other new thing is permanent redirects. You've always had the response.redirect that you could use in the framework. When someone comes to a particular page, you send them over to another page. Unfortunately, a lot of search engines look at the temporary redirects and they either don't follow them or they don't tend to categorize or catalog the fact that that thing has moved. And what you really want is for people, when they search, to find your new page. And so the permanent redirect simply sends back a different status code to HTTP. It's a pretty minor thing under the covers, but it makes a big difference to how the search engines then catalog that, right? They'll see that that thing has permanently moved, and they'll update their indexes so that now when people search, instead of finding your old page, they're going to directly go to the new page. Probably the biggest thing, right, those are kind of small changes that are easy to implement and work with. The biggest thing is the routing capabilities that were introduced before for ASP.NET MVC and the dynamic data has now moved in and is available with web forms as well. How many of you are familiar with the routing features in ASP? A handful? Okay. Essentially what routing does is it allows you to, in your URL, identify as part of the path things like the parameters that normally you would use in query strings. It allows you to make friendlier URLs where, instead of having something like, you go to a news site, instead of having something like article ID equals and some big ugly number that nobody knows, right? It might be articles/, and then the title of the article, right? Which is really what people are looking for. They're looking for information when they're searching for news about a particular event. Right? And so if that's in your URL, it's more likely to pop up in the search engines. So what they've done in the routing is they've added in this capability now, like I said, you could do this before. This is kind of the default way you did things with MVC. You can now go in and for the web forms you have, you can add routes. And a route essentially allows you to map and say, look, when you see a URI structure that looks like this, here's the page that you should actually call. Right? So when you see that article slash and then some title of a news article, you should go to my article.aspx page and render that. So it gives the user the ability to put in a nice friendly URL, and it then knows how to route that to an actual page that can respond. Now, once you get into that page, you need access to those parameters. Right? If you were using query strings before, you could get at the query string parameters and any other parameters that were coming in. One of the features of the routing is they've added in the ability for you now to get access to those route values. Right? So when I specify my URL, I'm going to identify certain parts that are static and certain parts that are going to be parameters or values that are that make part of the route, but also then come down to me as data elements that I can use. In your ASPX, right, you have a couple of new things that you can use. You have the route URL, and you have the route value. These are expressions that you can use inside of your angle brackets in your ASPX. The route value is the one that allows you to explicitly say, you know what, I'm going to set a property, I'm using the value, I want to grab a certain value out of that URL, and I want to put it right here. The route URL makes it easier for you to create a link to a route. So before, if you were creating a link to a page, you do the ASPX and you put the parameters in, this allows you to go in and say, look, I need to create a route that looks appropriate for this news article. All right, I need, here's the name of the route, here's the parameters. Please make it look right based on your configuration. So you don't have to do a bunch of string concatenation and make everything fit together just right. And we also have for the data source controls and other places where you pass in parameters, we've got the route parameter. So just like you could declaratively put together and say, hey, you know what, I want to use a data source control. I want to pass in a value for the ID or the title, and that value is going to come from another control, or that value is going to come from the query string or from session or profile. Now you can say, well, that value is actually a route value that got passed into me in the query string. So if we go out here, I've got a website, and I've got a page right now that I called movie search. So if we go out and view this in the browser, I'm going to bring me back a whole bunch of stuff. All right, and what it allows me to do is come in and say something like title equals, let's do Star Trek and see what I've got. All right, Star Trek. So it's a search page. It allows me to come in. I'm using query strings now. And what this is doing is just going out against my data source and querying against that. I want to change this. I want this to be more integrated. So I want to do something like this. I want to do movies slash title because I want it to all be part of the URL, not just query string parameters. So what I'm going to do is go in. I've got a page called movies route that's going to handle this. And what I need to do is create a route that tells ASP.NET when somebody puts in a URL like that, it should use this page to render it. So I'm going to get into my global ASAX. And in my application start, I'm going to just say something like create routes, route table.routes. And then I'm going to ask it to implement that method for me. Of course, it doesn't do a very good job of implementing it. It just throws an exception, but it gives me the stub. So now my job is to tell it, all right, well, what are the different routes that I want to create? So I do route collection dot map page route. So I can give the route a name. Might call it something like movie search. I can give it a route URL. So it's going to be movies. And then I'm going to put in the title here. And then I need the physical file. I called it moviesroute.aspx. And so what I've told it is, look, I have this route. I've given it some name, which just allows me to refer to it in certain places by name. I've given it a path or a route that says, here's what people are going to put in the URL. And the curly braces essentially call out that that title piece is a parameter. It could be any string that they put in. And I could put in, you know, other ones as well. So I could do something like that as well, right? Where you could search for a particular title and a release date or release year. Right? You can have multiple parameters in the path like that. And so when you see a URL like that, here's the page you should call. Well, movies route now is going to get called, but it's not actually going to have information in the query string. So I need to write it a little differently. Before I do that, I'm going to create one other route here. I've got a reviews route for movie reviews. I'm going to put that in. And that one will take a particular ID. So if you call reviews slash and then give me an ID of a movie, then that should return the reviews for that particular movie. And so at this point, if I go out now and I go to my movies route, I've got certain things in here. I've got at the top just a little span. And here I'm using that route value and title. Right? So this is where I get an expression. I get at a particular route value by name. And so this name is going to match up with that parameter name right over here. Right? It's essentially a dictionary. So I'm going to get that value out. And here I'm just putting it out in text. Right? I'm just going to display it so we can see it. But I've also got a search going on. And so I'm going to use the route parameter to filter my database. And so I'm going to say the route key is title. And the name of the parameter happens to be title as well. And so that's going to allow me to take that value out of the query string, whatever that parameter is in the route, and use that as a parameter to my search, right? Much like I was doing on the other page. So if I build now and I come in, I should be able to do what I wanted, which is, doesn't look much different. There we go. Movies, all right, Star Trek, if I come in. My kids are big into Star Wars right now, right? So now my query string, right, the path actually has that information. So now if somebody's out searching and they want to find that information, my URL is going to come up higher in the rankings because it's part of the path, it's part of the name. Right? Let's see if I got this right. So I've got a link here for the reviews. And if I look, you can see up here, it's just reviews. /244, right? A particular review ID. Now, I could switch that around. It could be reviews slash and then the movie title, right? Which again would probably give me better search rankings if somebody's looking for reviews for a particular movie. They're going to see in my URL the name of the movie, the word reviews. That's going to give me a better search result. Okay. So questions about the routing piece? Does that make sense? Thank you. Somebody said yes. It's always one of those things where you say, does that make sense? And nobody says anything and you think, it does or it doesn't. I have no idea. So how many of you are using are thinking about search engine optimization and doing things in your site to optimize for search? Some of you? Okay. All right. Now, so the other thing I might do then is on my movies route, right, I might come up here. I've got in my master page, I've got the header. So I might come up in here and I might want to look at the meta keywords. So I can get at the meta keywords, I can get at the meta description. So I might say, like, movie information for, and then I can get at the page, and I've got that route data as well in code. So if I need to encode, get at those things. I've got data tokens. I've got the route. I've got the route values. So I can go out and add that together. Now if we go back out here. Oh, I knew I put a space in there somewhere. There we go. So now if I go out and view the source, you can see my typo. You can also see that now I've got that metadata information up there, content movie information for Star Wars, right? So again, I've got key search information that I can programmatically set. When I'm using this page to access and work with a number of different things, I can put that information up in the metadata and in the keywords as well. So another area where they've been focusing is focused on creation of the HTML. Right? One of the if you get into this sort of thing, there's all sorts of battles now, and people getting into wars about MVC versus web forms, and a lot of people's draw towards MVC, or a lot of what people talk about as a big thing, is, well, I have complete control over the HTML. Right? Whereas with web forms, I'm using all these server controls, which are great, and they make things, go really fast, and I can hook them all together. But they do all sorts of crazy stuff with the HTML. They're putting tables in where I don't want tables. They don't work well with cascading style sheets. And so a lot of the focus on the web form side of thing has been to clean up some of that, right? To provide better ability to style some of the controls and better ability to have control over the rendered HTML. One of the big ones is the client ID. All right, if you've worked with ASP.NET and you've tried to do any JavaScript, you know that the IDs that get generated on the client for your controls end up being these big, crazy, ugly things. Right? Especially if you do data binding and you've got repeating things, the IDs end up being this concatenation of the whole hierarchy of activities or of controls. And so by the time you get down and you try and go select one item by ID, it's really difficult to do. All right, so you have this new client ID behavior that allows you to control how that works. So we'll take a look at that in a second. Now, there's a bunch of different things that they've done in the standard controls around the cascading style sheets. So the validation controls, almost, they used to, it was always red. If you did something wrong, it was red. But now you use cascading style sheets instead. And so you can put out a class with your validation controls. You can use your styles, right, and apply those like you would any other piece of your HTML. They've made a number of changes to some of the controls that used to render those tables. Somewhere in the last, I don't know how many years, there's this big shift from tables to using style sheets to position everything. I started learning HTML back, when it first came out with Mozilla, and I just thought tables were awesome, right? I did tables everywhere. Somewhere along the line, I found out that was no longer cool. Everybody does everything with style sheets now. Well, Microsoft had all these controls that rendered tables, right, that ended up causing problems for people that were trying to style those things. And so now things like the login and the form view, right, all these kind of authentication authorization controls, they had these tables on them, and they've added this flag now where you can say render outer table equal false. You basically just turn it off. The wizard controls, right? Similarly, if you want to turn off some of their automatic formatting, as soon as you start applying templates and telling it how to lay out, they turn off the automatic stuff. The big one is the menu, right? Again, this is one where they were tables, and people hated that. All right, so they've updated it now. It uses unordered list and list items, and it applies styles in order to give you the menu functionality. It does have an option now, too, where you can control the style piece and indicate whether you want to have the style block pulled out and included in the page or not. A couple other changes, right? The checkbox and radio button list. Before, you had the table and flow options. Now you can also do unordered or ordered lists. So if you want to lay those out in a vertical fashion, you can do that. And one of the things that they had to be careful of is that you have existing sites. You're already using all these controls, right? They start going and making changes to how these things render and the workarounds you've already put in place, and then your site starts looking awful or just not working. So they have a mechanism in the config for you to set on the pages the compatibility version back to 3.5, right? So you want to take a site, you want to move it over and go live, but you don't have time to fully test everything out and update things, you can make sure that all the client control rendering stuff still uses the old model and that things keep working as they were. So let's go back in here. So if we take a look, we'll just take a look at a couple of these things so you can kind of see. If you look at the menu here, right, we've got the navigation menu. In the new project, when you do a new web project in Visual Studio 2010, there's a couple things that are different. One is they put in not only some of this default content, but they actually give you some styling. Right? You saw that this is taking over from what MVC did as well, that I get an application that's already got the login set up, and I've got login pages and change password. I've got a menu. I've got, you know, some styles applied. So they give you a place to start when you do this. They also give you a very stripped down web config. All right, I've added in some connection strings. And we've got the authentication and membership in the new one. But that's pretty much it. All right, so the only things that have been added in here are just the key pieces we needed to get the login pieces working and the profiling and things. There's not all that other garbage that you get with Visual Studio 2008. You get all the IIS 7 settings and the compilation, all the assembly pieces and the pages. All that stuff is just moved up to machine config because it was in every web app. And so now you have a lot less to dig through here. So if we take a look at that menu, and I'll zoom in here in a second. If we go in using the developer tools, oops, go into the header. There's our menu. And so you can see it's a div. Right, they're just using CSS and applying the classes. They've got the unordered list for the particular menu items, and then they keep track of things like the CSS pieces are right embedded in there, right, in this particular case. And they have the different levels, right, identified in here, so they apply the styles based on a number of these different settings. But instead of having a table, they've kind of gone with what's the new convention now. So let's take a look at the client ID, because that's really the big one. If I look at my my page here, my list view is where all the rendering is happening. And so by default, you know, I've given this list view an ID of movie list. Right? I've got a panel out here with an ID of movie line. If we go out and take a look at our page, I can remember how to move these. if we go out and take a look at the source for this, you're going to see the ID for these things. It's just this big concatenation of the main content. That's my placeholder in the master page. All right, and I've got this movie list. I've got all these things kind of concatenated together in here. And just some random numbers plopped on the end, right? That just is the index of which item was thrown out there. Well, I could probably use that in some fashion and figure out and dig down in here and find some things. But what I really want is more control over what that thing looks like so that I can put particular values in there that I want to use and look for. So we've got this new setting on the controls where I can come on to the list view, and I have this client ID mode with four values. I've got auto ID, inherit, predictable, and static. Now the auto ID is what you got before. Right? So if you set that, that's exactly what was happening before. The inherit setting basically just as well, look up the parent and see what it's doing. Static means, hey, look, I gave this thing an ID. Stop messing with my HTML and just leave it, right? Put it in. I know it's right. I'm a good developer. I'm a smart developer. I know that it's the only thing on the page with that ID, right? So just write it out like I told you to. And the other one is a little less aggressive towards ASP.NET. It's called predictable. It says, look, I want you to do this, but I want to have a pattern that I can follow. And with that, I'm going to pass in this ID row suffix, and I'm going to give you a data item or a data field. So I'm iterating over things, which is primarily where this is an issue. I'm iterating over things, and I need to create IDs that follow a pattern I can understand, and then actually have some data in them that I can use. So now I'm telling it, don't just give these things an index as you go through. Actually give it the movie ID as part of that ID. And so now as we go in, it doesn't look a lot different, but notice that I've got that ID at the end now that I can actually use, right, if I want to go out and do something with this thing. So now I could come in here and I could maybe do a script. Right, and on my master page, I've pulled in the jQuery, so I could do something like this. So essentially, when the document's ready, I want to go out and I want to find all of the items with a class of movie list or movie line. I've got these down here. And I want to add on to them, right? I want to put something on their click, right? So that when you click on those, something happens. So just using some script, go out and find all those lines. And I want to put a click handler on those divs. And so I can say, well, the full ID is going to equal the ID. All right, so whatever this thing is that you clicked on, I'm going to grab the ID off of that. And then I can go and get the movie ID. And from here, I want to get that last little bit. So I'm going to get everything after that. We'll see if my JavaScript casing is right here. Right, and then I could just do something like window.location equals, and I had reviews. Movie ID. See if I typed all that right. So now if I go out to a particular item, oh, I didn't lose the underscore. So now I can click on that. I can use the ID then to go out and set that. So I've actually got the ability to have more control over the client ID, so I can access it. So it's got some value to me. So I can go out and find those particular items that I'm interested in. So on the data side, we've got this new control called the Query Extender Control. It supports both the entity data source and the link data source. And what it does is kind of takes us a step past just the, select, where, order by, and gives you a variety of different search criteria that you can apply to those data sources so that you can do in range comparisons, or you can do string style comparisons against particular fields, all right, to see if a particular field contains some value or starts with a value. You can do a particular property match, you know, when this particular field is equal to a certain value. So it gives you the additional support beyond the where, and it allows you to pull in the parameters from the routes, from the query strings, from other controls on the page. Right? Whereas before, that was a little more challenging to do, and it allows you to put in some custom ones as well. So we've seen this already. Dug into it, but I have this entity data source that's going out, and I've got my entities out there, and then I use the query extender, and I can do things like here. I'm using this range expression. I'm saying, look, I want to go out, and for the release date, I want to apply a particular range and say I only want things where that date fits into this range, right? Or I want to do a search expression against the title, and I've got options on how I want to do that comparison, right? If I want it to be culture specific or invariant, what type of search do I want? I've got contains, ends with, starts with. And then I can use these parameters. And again, I can plug in route values or query string values in here as well, and use those then to filter that data source dynamically. Now, the one thing about this, you know, if you look at the design, when you get to the data source, you know, and you configure the data source, you get this nice wizard to walk through, and you have all these settings you can do. But when you get to the query extender, there's not a whole lot that you can do in here. Right? You can set the target control, and you could do some other things, but there's no wizard, there's no other kind of guideline. So it's really going to be a markup thing where you're going to go in and define those search criteria within the markup of your page. All right. So kind of on the data front, how many of you are familiar with the ASP.NET dynamic data? A handful. Okay. So this is something that came out, I think it was in the 3.5 Service Pack 1. And the idea is that I want to go build a website, and what I want to do is quickly get up and running, and my website does all sorts of CRUD operations on a database. I've got a typical business scenario where the business says, hey, we need to go out and we've got this data, and we need, you know, forms essentially to manage that data. And so what dynamic data does is it quickly gets you a website up and running with full access to your model. You usually build it against an entity data model, and scaffolds out the whole site. So you just say new website, configure it for your data source, and then out of the box, you're up and running. Now, that's probably not the end, right? In some scenarios, you might be finished, but it then goes further and allows you to customize the UI, and you decide at what level that takes place. You might just want to customize and say, you know what? I need my date time fields to look differently. I need my I need my social security numbers, right? That's a particular field that we use, and I want those to get displayed a certain way, right? Maybe mask out the first parts of things. And so you can customize at that level, at the field level. You can also, right, it scaffolds out the whole site and says, look, I'm just going to give you, right, the ability to go out and work with any of these entities. You might say, you know what, that's okay for a large number of them, but I want specific pages that I use for certain pieces of data, right? When we're working with a customer, I want to have a custom page that I write that allows me to do that. So it lets you go in and customize in that scenario. And what they've done is made some improvements in 4.0 to add new templates for certain types. So email and URLs now, they've got a certain template that will render those a certain way. They've got some control over the naming and the rendering order. So there's this new display attribute that you can apply to your whatever your entities are that you're using. And that will influence how those things get laid out in the order they go in. And there's also support for filtering. So when you're on a particular page and you're looking at a set of data, they automatically provide you filter values. So let's say you're looking at a list of products, right? And you've got a field that identifies a certain characteristic of the product. That may surface up as a filter where you can have a drop down and say, look, I want to filter these products by that field. So they've added the support now for the entity framework. One of the things they added was they now actually support if you've got derived types. So if you have in your model, you have a person and you have a derived type that's a customer, they can actually support that now in the model, and you get a page where you can edit the customer and it correctly saves back to the data store. Let me go out here. I'm just going to add a new project. If I go to web, I get this dynamic data entities. Right? And you can see you've got one for link to SQL as well. We'll use the AdventureWorks here because that's the new standard. Right? And you'll see that the site doesn't have very much in it. Right? It's got a default page. It's got the standard jQuery scripts. And then it's got all this stuff under dynamic data. This is where all these templates come in, where you can find things like field templates. Oh, here's what an email address is going to render like. It's going to be a hyperlink. And it's going to be, take whatever that field value is and stick it in there. So now I can see, right, and I have control over what this actually looks like. If I've got integers, right, notice it's integer underscore edit. So if you're in a page and you're editing an integer, this might look different, right, than if you were just viewing one. So let me go into the global ASAX here, which it opened up for me. And I need to kind of set up the scaffolding here. So it's got it commented out. I'm going to go in and I'm just going to add a reference over to my project that's got some data in it. So I've got a project with a set of entities, an entity framework. So I'm going to put that in. And I'm going to come over here and say scaffold all tables equal true. And I'm going to ask it to restart. So this is kind of the rough starting place. Yes, please do recover. The rough starting place, and then I would filter down from here. I didn't get my reference there. Well, that's not what I want to do because I wanted to do I'll do AdventureWorks. Let's go in and just add it in here. So we'll go in and add a entity model. Hope that this works better than crashing. So I've got the connection string. It's going to go out. We'll just get all the tables. Finish that. and make sure we save everything. We'll do the adventure work to entities, and then we'll say scaffold on tables equal true. Over lunch, I'll be restarting my laptop and hope that has some sort of an impact. Doesn't like me to say scaffold equal to true. Save. Wow. Repeatable bug. Somebody write that down. All right. Let's see if we do it backwards. Ah, that guy keeps coming in. Shouldn't be using the magnifier. That must be it. We're going to trick it. Paste, save. Save, save. All right. Thank you. Yes, I've won. It's a small battle, but it makes me feel good. All right, so let's set that as the startup. All right. So I basically created this dynamic data slide. I said, look, here's my model of the AdventureWorks database, you know, whatever my database is. And I asked it to go ahead and just scaffold everything, right, just to get started. And so it's created for me all these different table names. If I go to the default page, right, it allows me to go out to any of these things. And so if I go to contacts, it's going to show me, all right, great, here are all the contacts. And I can filter. You can see name style's a Boolean. It's got a checkbox. So I go in and indicate, oh, there aren't any people with a name style of true. I want to do false. All right, and I might come in and it's not going to let me check. Oh, because I'm not editing. So if I go into edit, all right, then I get a particular layout for editing an entity. All right, and it's pretty basic. All right, it's essentially just a form where they've automatically scaffolded out for each field. I'm going to give you a row. Right. And then depending on the type of the data, I'm going to give you the appropriate editor. Right. For most of them, it's a text box. But for some of them, it's a multi-line text box because this one happens to be a bunch of XML. Right. And then I've got links here to all the related items. So I'm looking at a particular contact. I might want to look at the sales order headers. All right. So these are the relationships that it's got in the database and allows me to just follow those over. So here you can see I've got a number of different filters at the top because there's all sorts of different items here that I can filter on, different credit cards, customers, salesperson, right? All these different relationships that they have, all these foreign keys essentially become filters that I can then narrow down my data with. So what I'm going to do, let me go back to the contacts. I'm going to come back in here and see if I can keep this from crashing long enough. I'm going to go into my model. I'm going to go find my contact. Find the email address. You can see that right now it's just it's a string. And I'm going to come in and say data type. And I'm using the system component model.data annotations namespace. This is another place where you're going to see a lot of frameworks starting to use this, including the MVC. The WCF RIA services, or the Rich Internet Application Services, they're all starting to use this as a way to attribute your data with information about the types, about validation. Right? There's all sorts of things in this namespace that they're using. So I'm going to say that that's an email address, right? Because string, right? String is the actual type, but I want to further call out that this has some particular type of data in that string, and that allows me to do things like, hey, if that says it's an email address, I should be able to validate that it's an email address. And I may want to present this differently if it's a string that's an email address as opposed to a string that's a street address. If I go back here now and I go to contacts, what you'll notice is that now that I marked it as an email address, it changed the way that it renders this. And it changed it for everything. All right. Anywhere it sees that contact email address now, when it renders it, it's going to render it using a different template. And that all gets driven by these items over here in my dynamic data, right? These field templates, where it says, hey, look, if it's an email address, I'm going to go look for a field template of that name. And for that, I'm going to go and render a hyperlink. If I want to change how that renders, just come in here and make a change to that template. Get rid of that guy since I don't want to go back there. And you can see that I changed that template and now it picks up everywhere that that type is rendered. So you can use those data type attributes to call out something like this, where maybe it's a string, but it's actually an email address. You can use those field templates for items where it's a particular type. You know, so if it's a date time and you want to render date times a certain way, you can put those in there as well. So the other thing you can do in here, if we go into the global, you can see it kind of gives you the information here. There's a couple different ways you can do the scaffolding, right? You can mark, create partial classes and put this scaffold equal true, right? So if you don't want to do all of them, you just have certain things that you want to quickly enable people to go in and view and edit, you can go in and attribute those particular entities and say, yes, I want you to scaffold this, right? And you don't have to do it on the designer generated class, because obviously if you regenerate it, you're going to lose that. You can just create a partial class of the same name and put your attributes on there. All right. And then, of course, you can take advantage of the routing piece as well. All right. So if you want to, you can put it in. You can see they've got a dynamic route where you have a table, oops, and some sort of action, .aspx, right? So you put in that route, then it goes in and puts in some constraints, right? Gives you this list of route values, the list details edit insert, right, for you to be able to go in and get those values out in that dynamic page. Right. So I mentioned that the Ajax stuff got interesting over the last couple weeks. There's been all these releases of the Microsoft Ajax 4, Preview 1, Preview 5, Preview 6. I don't know how high they got. Right, where they were just kind of dropping the Ajax bits separate from Visual Studio and ASP.NET and allowed you to just go out and get them more quickly. You didn't have to wait, you know, between a beta 1 and a beta 2, and you could see what they were doing. And they were doing all sorts of things around templates, client-side data templates. Well, at Mix, last week or the week before, my days are all mixed up now, one of the big things that they announced is Microsoft now is working very closely with the folks that work on jQuery. So jQuery, very popular JavaScript library, right? It's included now with Visual Studio, right? So when you go out and you create a new web project, it's there. You get the jQuery scripting library included. And they've gone a step further and basically said, look, we're not going to put a whole lot of effort into the Microsoft Ajax JavaScript libraries, because we've already kind of started encouraging people to use jQuery. They're doing a lot of cool stuff. It doesn't make sense to be doing things in parallel. And so Microsoft has taken all the stuff they were doing with the client data templates and basically said, well, we're going to contribute that to jQuery. So they've taken kind of a slimmed down approach, but they now have a proposed client-side data template model that they've proposed over to jQuery, and people get to vote on it and decide what needs to change in it before it actually gets included in there. And so things have really kind of changed in terms of the Ajax space, in that Microsoft itself is not going to be putting in a new, you know, client-side scripting things. It's all going to be going towards towards jQuery. So if you were thinking that maybe it was time to learn jQuery, it is. If you're doing web development, that's really the way that people are going for doing client-side development. You know, if you're doing scripting, if you're not doing Silverlight or something else. They did do a couple of interesting things with the JavaScript though and the Ajax pieces. One is they made it a little easier for you to manage your scripts. So you've probably used the script manager on your ASPX pages, and you're able to point to a particular script and say, hey, this is the one that I want. But what happens when you want to do debugging and then you want to go to production? And now you need to remember to go into your pages and, right, hopefully a master page, and change so that you're no longer using the debug version, you're using the min version, right, or something like that. So they've added this notion that I can do script resource mapping in my project. So if we go look at my master page here in my web app, I've got this. I've got my script manager, and underneath it I said, hey, I'm running the jQuery scripts. Right? Well, I'm not using the minified version, so when I go into production, if I ship this now, everybody's going to be downloading the kind of the uncompressed, the big version. And so what I want to be able to do is, instead of doing that, I want to say name equals jQuery. Right? Now, obviously, that's got to map onto something. So if I go into my global ASAX, I'll come in here and I'll register scripts, generate that. So I can register and do my script resource mapping, add definition. You can see that what it wants is a name. Give it jQuery, and it wants a new script resource definition. And now I can go in and say, well, look, I've got a debug path. See if I can type these all correct. I've also got a path. It's going to look a lot like that. And if you want, you can do, right, content delivery networks. So now Microsoft's scripts and jQuery are all out on these big content delivery networks, you know, around the world, cached and on these big servers. The jQuery stuff, I think, is cached out by Google. So you could also put in here and you could say, well, I want to also configure that, hey, when I go out in production, I'm going to want you to use that content delivery network. Right, so those are the paths to where that exists out there. Let me see if I got that. I got my file names exactly right. I think so. So if that worked, all right, now referencing it by this and build, then my little script that I added in out here should continue to work. If not, it will be par for the course and things breaking today. All right, so that still works. All right, I still get the jQuery now, but my page, right, in this case I added a master page, but now I don't have to worry about pointing to a specific value. So I've got one place I can set it up so that I do things. We go to the script manager. You've got the ability in here, right, to do the enable CDN. And then there's another one in here, if I can remember the name of it, that identifies that it does the script mode. So you can say auto, right, where it'll go out and say, well, what build are you doing? Are you doing a debug or a release build? And go out and figure out which scripts to pick up then for you automatically. So there's also, you know, the team has released this thing called a script minifier. So if you're building your own scripts and you've got, you know, all sorts of script and you want to do what they've done with the jQuery and the Ajax libraries and you want to shrink those down, right? They've got this minifier that not only takes out all the white space and all the extra stuff you don't need, but also does some smart things around renaming variables, right, inside of the functions, shrinking those down to really small names, right? So they can really compact these things down nice and small. So they've released a tool. You're not going to find this out of the box with 2010, but you can download it, include it in part of your build, and take your large scripts and then shrink those down as part of your build process. So just mention a couple things, right? We've got snippets now and better JavaScript IntelliSense. There's a lot less kind of messing around with your HTML. We've talked about that a little bit. There's also this integration in Visual Studio with the web deployment framework. So this is a new framework that Microsoft's been working on that's all about helping you take your applications, package them up, and deploy them out to a server, deploy them out to multiple servers, make a change and sync it across a variety of servers. So you'll see this in Visual Studio. When you go into a web application and you say, hey, I want to package and publish this, there's all sorts of settings on here now, right, where you decide what it is you want to include. Right? You can include all databases configured in the package publish SQL tab. Right? So if you go over here, you've got databases that you can put in. So part of the package, maybe that you want to package up your SQL database as well. And it'll, you can give it the actual web application. And notice that what it's going to create is this movies.web.zip. It's basically going to create you a zip file, right? And so you have this mechanism then. You can do I'm doing a debug build. I'll put it off on the file system. I'll just put it on my desktop for now. And I actually have to view the files. So here, right, I just did the standard deploy of the app. You can also package it up and say, you know what, I want to create a package, or I want to deploy out to the website as well. So they take advantage of the build deployment package. Right, that's going to be in my object debug. I go to Windows Explorer. All right, so now I've got a zip file with all these things in it. I've got a manifest, and I've got a batch file out here that's going to deploy that. And so it uses this MS deploy tool now. Right, and there's actually quite a bit going on in here in terms of arguments, but it's going to use this command line tool now to go take that zip package in the manifest and allow me to go and run that and install it on another server, right? And I can put, like I said, the database pieces and all those things in there as well. IIS has also, just to touch on this, IIS has been updated with some of these features as well. So if you go into a particular when you say export package, you can see you've got a lot of that same capabilities in terms of, you know, what kinds of configuration do you want to export? What components do you want to put out? All of this stuff now is getting integrated into IIS, Visual Studio, all using this MS Deploy framework to package your websites along with configuration, not just for the site, but for IIS. Because now that IIS 7 drives everything off of web config instead of the old goofy metabase that previous versions used, I can take my web app and all the settings can be in that app in the config files. So you can take it and drop it onto IIS 7 now. So the last thing we'll look at, the couple of changes to MVC. How many people are using the ASP.NET MVC to build sites today? Okay. Not too many. So ASP.NET MVC is a different model. I'm not going to get into to all the details here. I'll just touch on a couple of the new features, but it's a different model than the web forms model in that you have controllers, which are classes that you write, and you have views. And so it's all about separation of concerns, right, where your views actually are just markup. There's no, you know, very little code in there. And if there is, it's related to laying out the controls. There's no server controls. But you have this, you have these helper methods. And so what they've done in ASP.NET MVC 2 is they've added a couple of features. One is they've made it easier for you to use some of the same kind of techniques they have in dynamic data. You can say, hey, you know what? I have a particular way that I want to render certain types. So it might be that I have a particular way that I want to render a date time, or I have a particular way I want to render an email address, but it might also be I have a particular way I want to render a customer, right? And so you can lay out and say, whenever you want to, when I want to, I want to say, hey, go give me the display for a customer. They take advantage of that, the validation support from the data annotations, and they've also added this notion of areas. And this is about segmenting up your site so that you might have the main site and then sub areas underneath it, right? An admin section. Maybe you've got a website and you've got one section that's press releases or blogs. It allows you to separate that out, especially for team development, and have certain people working on different areas of the site. So if we go look at our MVC app here. Let me just go out and start this. It's going to look up very similar to the other one. I've added a menu tab here. So you can see up here the routes, right, are kind of an intrinsic thing. That's really part of MVC, and that's where a lot of the routing capabilities started in the Microsoft web space, is that your routes aren't about going to a particular ASPX. They're about going to a particular controller and then an action on that controller. So right now, it's looking for the movie controller. That's my class that's responsible for responding to this. And because I didn't specify, then I'm getting the index view of that. Now, so what they've added is a couple of things. If I go and edit a movie, you can see that I've got a couple things here. The default layout looks like this, right? They just, again, much like that dynamic data, when you go in and you create a new view for something, you can tell it, hey, I want to do an edit view. And it'll give you some HTML that lays it out in a pretty straightforward fashion. So if we go look at my model here, you can see for the movie controller, essentially what happens is when you go to WAC movies, that gets routed here, and I'm simply going out and just getting a top 100 movies and then returning a view. I say, well, here's a view and here's the data for that view. Well, it's going to go out and look under my views under movie and find this index ASPX, right? So that's kind of how MVC works. And so they've added a couple different things. One is if we go look at my models, my entities that I work with here, I can now use all of these things from that data annotation. So I can say, hey, you know what? If you're going to submit a review, the reviewer is required, and I can put some constraints around things like the string length. I've got for the rating, I've got a range. Right? If we're going to rate a movie, then you're only allowed to go 0 to 10. Right? And I've got some other constraints on there. And so what will happen is, these things automatically get picked up, and when I go out here, if I try and enter a review or edit a review, if I do something like this and I just try and take that name off and hit save, right, the framework automatically picks up on that and uses those data annotations to give me back that error message. Right? And so if I look at my controller, right, I'm saying if you post back the edit, right, and all I have to do is check if this model state is valid. Right? And so if that's true, then what I'm going to do, normally you'd save it off to the database or do something. I'm just going to send them back to the homepage. But if not, I'm going to send them back that same view, right, with that same data, because that's just going to re-render and it's going to see that the model is invalid, and it's automatically going to show me those error messages for that particular property. So I can simply attribute those things and pick that up. Oops. I think it was something like that. So I might do something on the rating, like make it 16, right? Again, that gets picked up So those data annotations now are the mechanism for doing this data validation on your objects. The other thing, as I mentioned, is the editors or the displays. So if I go look under movie, this is where all my views are for things related to movie. I add this special folder called display templates. And now I can put ASCX files under here, or web controls, and name them for a particular item or type. And then in my pages, I can request those. So I can say, you know what, I've got a date time ASCX here. And all I'm going to do is do a model to short date string. So I'm going to create a text box, and I'm going to do the short date string. So anytime I see a date time, I want to do that. Now, again, for backwards compatibility, they couldn't just start applying these everywhere. So what they added was, if you go into a particular page, we look down here for my date time, you can see before what it was doing was just doing a text box for a particular item. Right, and they've added this notion of expressions where I can pass in and say, hey, I've got a model, lambda expression, I want to do model.release date. Right. And so instead of doing text box, I said, I want to do display for. And that's what triggers it. That's what tells MVC, go look for one of these templates and see if you find a match. This thing's a date time, so go look for something called date time. And if you find it, that's how you should render the display for this thing. Right. There's also an editor for, which if I had date time underscore edit, it would go find that, and it would use that control then to render the date and time. So they've added these helper models, and this is kind of where we, you know, there aren't server controls. We don't have the ability to just drag and drop things in. This HTML class, the helper class, is what really drives a lot of the simplification of UI in MVC. And so it's going to help you use these templates to come out and simplify that and come up with consistent mechanism for doing that. And so you can see I can do that for the date time. I can also do it. I just simply came up here and added this at the top. I said, give me a display for, I do M, right, as my parameter. I'm basically saying, take the whole model, which is one of these movie model items, and go find the control to display that. So it's going to come over here and find this movie model item. Right. Where here I just simply do, I'll put about a white space in. I'm just going to do a div, and I'm going to have the title, right, followed by the release date in parentheses. So if we go back and look at that page, right, you'll notice that that's how it rendered it. So I said, hey, here's a class, a type, go find me the display template for that, and use it to render this object. So it went out and found the ACX, parsed it, ran that object through it, and gave me the specific layout for that. So you have display templates, you have editor templates, you use that display for and editor for, and it'll go out and find those based on the type, or you can pass it a name, and it'll use those then. And so if you use the display for and the editor for throughout your site, you again have one place to go where you can say, look, everywhere I'm showing a date time, I want it to show up a certain way. Right? I want it to have maybe a jQuery-based date picker that goes along with it. So I'll just change that ASCX, and now everywhere I've used date times and used that editor for, you'll get a nice UI, and if I need to change things like the background color, the font, or whatever my users are, you know, nitpicking at that point of the game, I can go do it in one place instead of having to go through the whole site and change all those date time fields. And then the areas is pretty straightforward. You simply go in, say, hey, I want to add a new area. I'll just call it blog. And what you'll get is you need to register the area. Okay. And so when you come in, right, it'll indicate that it's going to map a particular route, right, for this thing so that we know that. Now in the URLs, if you go under blogs slash, now you're in that area. Now it'll pick up and try and find the appropriate controllers and actions to execute for you. And so once you've added the area, the only other thing you need to do is go to your Global ASAX, and make sure to do that. And just say register all areas. And so when the application starts, it'll go out, find all those areas, and make sure they get registered and get all their routes registered as well. There was a planned feature to do multi-project areas. That got pulled out of the core. I think that's in the MVC futures piece, but it didn't make it into the cut for the final RTM. So that piece isn't in here, but you can do areas within a particular website. Any questions about MVC, the dynamic data, any of the web forms pieces? Yeah. Which of the two is the most flexible? You're trying to start a war. You know, what do you mean by flexible, I guess, would be my... So if you want to have custom security, they both leverage the core ASP.NET model. So, you know, the MVC and the web forms are both going to use all the same infrastructure pieces like authentication and authorization, the profile service. All right, so it's really more, there's the ASP.NET core, and then there's the model you choose in terms of how you want to, you know, handle requests. Do you want them routed to a page or do you want them routed to a controller? And how you handle the views. So it's really more about that level of things. The core of ASP.NET sits underneath both of them, and so all the security and everything else still applies. Yes, sir. What's the difference between MVVM and MVC? So model, view, view model, and MVC. It probably depends on who you ask. MVC here is used to refer to the framework based on model view controller. Model view view model is a pattern that a lot of people are applying to in that space, whether it's with MVC, with Silverlight, with WPF, where basically you have a model, which you can think of as your entities. Maybe it's your entity framework entities or your business objects, and then you have a view model, which is a class that's specifically built to contain data for your view. Right? So rather than me handing my business object or my data entity to the view, I'm going to craft a kind of an intermediary class that's specifically designed for the view. Right? It has the properties and everything constructed. It might actually contain data from five different classes, but it's one thing that I can hand over to the view and have the view manipulate and work with and data bind to. And then when I get that back, I'd map it back onto the appropriate entity. So MVVM is a pattern that a lot of people are starting to apply, again, to kind of separate things out, keep things distinct, and so that the object that the view is working on is tailored to the view and is not necessarily manipulating directly your objects. All right. Why don't we go ahead and break for lunch? If there's any other questions, feel free to stop down. I think we'll start up again at 1 o'clock and talk about Windows Workflow.